This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. My guest today on The Literary Life is the wonderful Gish Jen. Gish, welcome to Books and Books.
Oh my God, it's my pleasure to be here.
You'll be reading in a little while.
Yep.
And unfortunately, we brought you some bad weather for a little while too. But the day, the sun will rise, the sun will shine once again here in Miami.
Soon as I leave.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll stay a little bit. But I hear you did get a little sun this afternoon.
Yeah, I got some sun this afternoon. Actually, I have to say, most of my tour, I've had sort of miraculously beautiful weather.
That's great.
So, you know, it had to break sooner or later.
And you live in Cambridge,
is that right? I do live in Cambridge, where we are grateful for every ray of sunshine that comes our way.
Most definitely you are. And now you're in sort of warmer climes. I have to say, you know, in preparing for this, for having you on today, it was really, really a lot of fun to go up on your website and to look at all of the wonderful interviews that you did. And I particularly enjoyed the deep dive that they did on C-SPAN, where they do that very long, you know, couple-hour discussion with you about your work and your life and about all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to do, though. And there's one little thing about that, which I now warn people who are going to be on the show about, and that is that, you know, you only get like a five-minute break. I mean, because you know,
right?
Yeah. So you know,
if your bladder has to be pretty good.
you got to go to the bathroom. I mean, you got to run, and run back
because it's live.
Because it's live, so that's the one thing about that show.
Well, we're here celebrating Gish's eighth book called The Resistors. The Resistors has been getting remarkable review attention. It's a favorite of booksellers all across the country. And it's a really, really, really good book. If you don't believe me, this is what Newsday says about it. This is a dark, frightening, and triumphantly original work, a 1984 for our time. It's the author's brilliant decision to pit the delights of the all-American pastime baseball as antidote to the rigors of the surveillance state. Pleasure versus pain, leisure versus labor, freedom versus regimentation. I have to say, Gish, when I read this, what it was very cathartic for me.
Oh,
because for me, I feel like we're living in very dark, scary times.
Yeah.
And the book has that kind of mixture of lightness and dark. It's not completely dark. There is some hope in it, in the embodiment of Gwen's parents and Eleanor and all of that sort of thing. Why did you choose to do something dystopic?
Well, you know, I sat down to this book in 2017. My daughter had just gone off to college, you know, so there she was. She was a freshman. And, you know, kind of in this tremendous moment of freedom, you know, I could have written about anything, right? But lo and behold, I did not write about some wonderful expedition to Patagonia. Instead, I found myself writing about, you know, parents watching their girl grow up and go off into the world. And then, of course, that was my state. I mean, I was watching my daughter go off into the world. And of course, you know, it's terrifying, you know? I mean, you look at, of course, you know, part of my worry is just a parent's normal worry, like, oh, my daughter's going to get involved with the wrong guy, you know, something like that. But in addition, you know, when I, you know, I'm suddenly looking at an actual young person, you know, preparing herself to do something about this world. And, you know, as I started to think about that, of course, you know, all my citizen worry kind of boiled up, you know. At the same time, you know, I'm looking at the young, they're pretty cool, you know. I mean, these kids are with it. You know, nobody has to tell them that they've got to take their studies seriously. Like, they get it. They understand that there are big jobs to be done. And, you know, the book is almost like a compendium of all the different things that these kids could focus on. You know, don't like climate change? You can think about the threat to democracy. don't like that. Well, you know, we're going to need legislation and AI. You know, I mean, it's like, I feel like, so there are plenty of ideas for my daughter and for all of her friends.
I think you checked off every fear that I have about the future, actually. Talk a little bit about the world that you created.
Well, you know, so this is a world that's set, you know, in someplace in the indefinite future. I don't really say when, but, you know, maybe 40 years from now, something like that, right? So it's a world that resembles our world, but it's different in many significant ways as well. America has become auto-America, right? And, you know, today our lives are very much mediated by the internet, of course. What we have today, we have like kind of 4G internet, right, with 5G being rolled out. And, you know, this, if you can imagine kind of a 9 or a 10 or an 11G internet, like what might that look like, you know? And so, you know, in my mind, that, you know, that internet, you know, is our internet, but with automation and AI features.
And no privacy.
Yeah, well, all that stuff, you know, and Alexa-like functions kind of, you know, on steroids now, right? So it isn't just, you know, we all know that Alexa is, you know, spying on us, but now we have the whole house is automated. And that's good news in the sense that, you know, it does clean itself up. You know, we like that. But it's bad news too, because it knows everything about you, you know? So if you move around, that, you know, there's like zone heat, right? So it knows, you know, just from where you're, you know, where you have your heating on, it knows how you're moving around. It knows everything about
you. So that's the technological fear.
Yeah.
Then you also deal with class. You deal with class in a big way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, so in the world of my book, you know, our current income inequality has just gotten worse and worse. And so now we have two classes of people, one of whom have jobs, those are the netted, and one of whom, you know, which does not have any jobs. And they're the surplus, right? And the surplus do have a universal basic income. And I will say that I did write this book before Andrew Yang. But lo and behold, even though they are given this money, you know, the netted are not really interested in funding these guys forever. And they're not interested in seeing this class procreate, right? I mean, they do not want to see, you know, more surplus to support all the time. And so, you know, so they engage in many activities, which, you know, would give us pause if we saw them going on today. Although, of course, they are going on today, right?
And then issues of race as well.
Yeah, interesting. You know, race has not gone away. You know, the race line has changed a little bit, you know, in the sense that there are many people who are Caucasian who are surplus, you know, but mysteriously all the people who are netted, surprisingly, surprise, surprise, right, are Caucasian, you know. So if you imagine, it looks a lot like, you know, honestly, what Silicon Valley looks like right now. Well, you know, so that they're, you know, they're, like I say, it's not just that all the colored, you know, are on one side and all the white are on the other side, but, you know, all the people who are in a favorable position are all white.
And then you've created this marvelous construct, this Aunt Nettie.
Mm. Right?
So talk about Aunt Nettie a little.
Well, Aunt Nettie is, you know, this kind of is the AutoNet. This is
right.
this 9, 10, 11G
right.
Internet. And so it is something which, you know.
But it's personified.
That's right. Because, you know, people talk about it as Aunt right. Nettie, you know. And of course, you know, in inventing Aunt Nettie, of course, I had Big Brother on my mind. But, you know, I think that the big difference between Aunt Nettie and Big Brother is, you know, Big Brother was a frightening entity, right? And Aunt Nettie is
part of your life.
Yeah, so. Well, she's friendly. Do you know what I mean? She's at your service. You know, she's consumer friendly, right? She's interested in you. She's interested in your problems. And so, you know, it's much, I think, much creepier, right? And I think it's the way, you know, you think about our relationship, you know, to Alexa and some of these other social media and so on. It's, you know, you know, they have us, but they have us because we've consented, right? We've consented to put ourselves under surveillance.
Well, this is what's so interesting to me as well, as to how this world became this world that you write about.
Yeah, yeah.
And in one of your interviews, you talk about how you have an ambivalence toward freedom. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I think that when we think about technology, there's a part of us that just wants to let it be whatever it can be, And maybe at some level we feel like it should be, right? I mean, there's no, you know, you don't really want to put checks on it, right? It's, this is like a great human invention. At the same time, you sort of wonder if, you know, if we are writing, it's a Frankenstein, you know.
Completely unregulated.
And completely unregulated. And so, you know, so I think that, you know, I have an ambivalence, you know, myself, you know, about regulation, which is, you know, in my New Yorker radio hour, Katie Waldman very smartly said, and it's very much like the way we feel about children when they go off into the world. Right. On the one hand, we want them to have complete freedom. Of course, of course, of course. On the other hand, we're terrified.
And we're very happy there's that tracking mechanism in iPhones.
Exactly.
You know, find my friend if they allow you to do that.
Find my friend,
like,
to keep an eye on where they are. You know what I mean? And which I have to say, you know, when my daughter was traipsing around Europe with her friend, you know.
It's very helpful.
You know, honestly, we were very happy to have find your friend, you know, and she, you know, she did agree to that. And we were just, you know, we just wanted, you know, like, where are they, you know, what, we can't know what's going on. But I'm sure that if there had been some function where we could also just kind of take a peek at that hostel, you know, at the neighborhood that hostel is in, you know, somebody sort of said, you know what I mean? Like, you know, pick of the neighborhood, you know, we would have pressed that button a minute.
You probably could have done that with Google Earth. Probably,
yeah. I mean, that's not very far away. So, you know, and that's one of the things about this, you know, that it's the urge to surveil. It's not just Aunt Nettie. We also have the urge to surveil. And as parents,
and that's what
we,
makes,
you know,
the book really so strong, is because it's rooted in so much of what we know now.
Yeah.
It's not... it's not something that we feel is so far into the future. It's just a little bit into the future,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Which really made me, as I say, it made me respond to it in a way that I was able to work out a lot of these demons of my own by reading this. And in the middle of it all, you have these resistors.
Yeah.
And the resistor and you use baseball as the primary kind of means in which people are resisting. And I just have to read, you know, one of a marvelous writer that I think we both admire who writes about baseball is the writer Jane Levy.
She's fantastic.
So she says, "I love this novel as much as I fear the future. Gish Jen has conjured... Oh, excuse me. I love this novel as much as I fear the future Gish Jen has conjured in it. In this anything but brave new world, baseball is what survives and reminds us of our humanity. And a girl's golden arm forms a kernel of resistance. What an enchanting conceit. Gish Jen has hit, of course, a grand slam." That must have been very gratifying coming from a writer.
Oh, my
baseball.
God. I was so happy to get that quote from Jane Levy. Well, especially because it also meant that I had gotten all the baseball right, which, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, baseball writers and baseball fans, I mean, boy, I tell you, you know, one false move and, you know, and you are toast. And and so I was extremely, extremely, extremely relieved to have passed muster with her.
Now, where did the baseball come from?
Well, you know, it's, you know, interestingly, I'm myself not really that much of a baseball fan, you know, but I do come from a baseball crazy family. So, my parents are Chinese immigrants and, you know, like many immigrants, you know.
You were born in New York.
I was born in New York.
Right.
Yeah. But my parents are from the Shanghai area. And, like many immigrants, you know, they kind of first performed being American by going to ball games. Right. So they would go to a ball game. You have a hot dog and, you know, you feel like, you know, you're now part of the fabric of society. Right. And in my mother's case, particularly, she became absolutely avid Yankees fan.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I mean,
and
the,
you live in
the most.
You lived in Boston.
Well,
one
that
for
we were in New York.
No, I know, but you lived in Boston.
Well, when that was a big thing when, you know, when part of the family became Sox fans, that was like a big deal. Anyway, but my mother, so I grew up with this family that, you know, weirdly had this incredible attachment to baseball. And I think I will say a very visceral understanding that baseball was America. Do you know what I mean? My mother's attachment to baseball was such that, you know, a couple summers ago, you know, she's in her 90s, and she was in septic shock. So she was very, very sick. She was comatose. She was not responding. We all rushed to her sick bed. thinking, you know, is it actually a priest who'd been called in for last rites? And as everybody is gathering, you know, in New York, you know, my brother leans over my mother and, you know, he's just trying to get her to respond, right? And what does he say? He says, "Mom," he says, "the Yankees are in a slump." He says, "The Red Sox are eating their lunch." And my mother, her eyes open up, and without missing a beat, she says, "That Aaron Boone should be fired." Aaron Boone, of course, is the manager of the Yankees. And I mean, it was just like, I mean, gonna say my mother is crazy about baseball. Wow. And wow. And my brother also, as it turns out, you know, my brother was actually
right.
was an ace pitcher, an ace pitcher, which they just something that they never would have found out. I think, if we've all been born in China, I don't know. Would anybody have discovered that my brother could really throw? But my brother could really throw. So, we were growing up in Yonkers, New York, which is a working class town where they take sports very seriously.
Sure.
I mean, seriously. So, the coach had played for the White Sox and, you miss one practice, you're out.
Oh, he played for the White Sox?
Yeah. Wow. No, it was like a training camp. They had like a baseball training camp. And you know, and a lot of these guys are fantastically athletic. And there was my brother. My brother was one of the best pitchers in the city. So when they had a father-son dinner and they invited Tom Seaver, who got introduced to Tom Seaver? My brother. They said, "Hey, this is our kid. This Chinese kid can throw," they said. Of course, they'd never seen a Chinese kid before. We didn't say, we're talking about being Chinese-American there either, by the way.
Right.
But this Chinese kid, and Tom Seaver, taught my brother to throw the curveball.
That's
so,
very cool.
In a gazillion ways, my brother found his place in American society through baseball. So you can sort of see
where that comes from. Then.
Yeah, you can sort of see it's very much embedded in my background.
Because in many ways, this is a book about family as well.
Absolutely.
It's so, the family is so well described, with Gwen and Eleanor. I mean, it's just really a very, very lovely family.
Well,
really.
Thank you.
And I think that had to have come from a place of your own as well.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a way in which, too, the way that the family kind of discovers
right.
that they have this girl with an arm, which
right.
they had never really thought about whether their daughter was going to have an arm.
No,
or not,
I love
right?
the idea.
But it's a little bit the way that my brother was discovered.
They discovered early when she was throwing
her stuffed animals
out of the crib.
but it's a little bit the way that my parents discovered that my brother could throw. It's kind of, you're not waiting for it. You're not expecting it. It just seems to come out of nowhere. I will say that I think many parents feel that. You know what I mean? Parents discover that their kids can do handsprings. They discover that kids can debate. They discover all kinds of things that they were truly you are not expecting. And all of a sudden, you find yourself with a kid who has something about them. And I will say a thing about them that makes us very different than computers. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think it is in those kind of gifts that we do, have this feeling like, there's something special about being human. And so
it's very analog.
There's a gift.
To do it. It's a gift that you have, a natural gift of one sort.
Yeah, but it's a special thing about humans
right.
that we have these kinds of gifts and it does make, so it does make us very different.
And because of that, because it's such a human gift, there is such a desire to keep it that way.
Yeah.
And to keep it separate from Aunt Nettie and everything else.
Yeah.
And
well,
that
was
one of the roots of the resistance in a sense.
Yeah. And so, of course, one of the other things that's going on is bioimprovement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, the question is like, well, what are we trying to, why don't we just bioimprove? What are we trying to protect, And the answer is there's something about these gifts that seem to come from nowhere that, you can argue, whether this is coming from, the divine or where it's coming from. But I think that many of us humans feel that were we to lose that, that we would have lost something very, 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 very precious and that our humanity is tied up with it, right?
So with all of the naturalistic novels that you've written, tell me, how this, the process of writing this was different.
Well, it was different. Well, part of the reason it was different was simply that I had a big chunk of time, which I never have. And that was partly because my daughter had left the house. So, I did not have to do grocery shopping. I mean, except for myself, but you know what I mean? I did not have to do meals. I just definitely didn't have to bring anybody around on a college tour or anything even slightly like that. So I had, truly, I could just write around the clock, which I had not been able to do since I was a graduate student, right? So many, many, many years.
Did it take also much research? Did you have to research?
Of course, I was also, lots of research around the baseball and AI as well.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky that because I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the AI was very easy to research. MTech, which is the MIT Technology Reviews conference, they very sweetly let me come gratis and sit in on their doing. So I had some sense of what the cutting edge looked like. And of course, there are all kinds of people to consult with in Cambridge. So I'm very, very, very lucky that way. And also, I will say that, just an incredible amount has been written about baseball, among things to research. It's a very easy thing to research.
And there's also an incredible history of baseball novels that go beyond the traditional kind
Absolutely.
Of baseball, trying to sort of explain life in one way or another.
Right, right, right. There's a wonderful poem. I don't know if you know this, Gail Mazur's poem, Baseball is not a metaphor. Mm. And of course, she starts it that way because baseball is a metaphor for everything.
Completely.
And it is an incredible microcosm of life. And I would argue of democracy, it's the level playing field. It's the idea that everybody should have a chance at bat. And it's also the idea that, that you can have an arena that's governed by rules that everybody agrees on, and that those rules will bring something out in us. You know what I mean? That they will enable to realize ourselves in a way that, we wouldn't be able to if it were not for those rules. And rules, by the way, that can be changed.
There's this wonderful kind of newsletter that I get that a friend of mine turned me on to called Baseball Codes.
Huh.
And it's basically an explanation of the kind of unsaid rules, the things you don't do as a baseball player.
Yeah.
Like you don't stand up and after you hit a home run, you don't embarrass the pitcher too much, those kinds of things. But it even gets into even more detail.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we're finding out in our politics now is that there is so much of our politics that's governed by codes and not necessarily by laws.
That's right.
And when someone breaks those codes,
right,
there's no recourse.
Yeah. That is absolutely true. And in any case, of course, the baseball in my book is kind of an idealized baseball. Do you know what I mean? We don't have any cheating. We don't have anybody banging on trash cans.
There's no Houston Astros.
There's no Houston Astros. So there's a way in which my book is kind of a dystopia, but it's kind of a utopia as well, right? So this is utopian baseball. And baseball, by the way, where, unlike our current Major League Baseball, where women get to play, you know? I mean, as part of my research, of course, I did read every biography and autobiography by women pitchers. And, to me, it's like, some of these guys were really good, I always think about, this league is one in which, for instance, Mamie Peanut Johnson played in the Negro Leagues. She was 5'3". She was 105 pounds in her uniform, soaking wet.
Wow.
but she could really throw. Satchel Paige taught her to throw. And, this is a world in which, Mamie Peanut Johnson would have gotten to play,
Oh, I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, actually. No, it'd be cool.
I would have really loved to have seen
it. It'd be cool. Some of these guys
it.
Were amazing.
Gish, you grew up, was it in Yonkers where you grew up?
I was Queens, then Yonkers, then Scarsdale, New York.
Okay. And
the classic immigrant progression.
Right, all the way up. Was writing something that came as an interest of yours very, very early?
Just a couple of years ago, I actually saw my third grade report card. And in it, the teacher had said, she really likes to write. So, my teachers noticed, in fifth grade, I moved to Scarsdale, New York, and, we had a little class magazine. And in retrospect, I remember, I wrote enough to fill that magazine up, 15 times over, And I did have the longest piece in it, by the way. 5 pages, mimeographed. It's all about a maid who stole some money and she hid it in a hat. And when they picked up the hat, it fell out. That's true. But I mean, so people would have said that they knew. But, I am the daughter of immigrants. So, people like me did not become writers, and especially my parents immigrated at such a difficult time. I mean, it's so early. I mean, I won't go into
what year. What year did they come?
In the 40s.
They came in the 40s.
So, in the years that, you understand that there were very, 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 very few Chinese Americans. Sure. And, it's a huge cultural difference. I mean, distance to have come. And, my father, what actually happened is my father was among the many Chinese engineers who came here really as part of the war effort. Mm. So back then there was talk about opening a second front against the Japanese in the Shanghai Harbor. So they had this big exam and they took these engineers and they were sent here so they could help coordinate that effort. And that was, my father's one of those.
And he
went all the way across China, all the way over the hump, which we now know to have been very dangerous. All the way across Europe, all the way Atlantic. By the time he got here, the war was over, right? But,
did he meet your mother here?
And he did. But, but those Chinese scientists, they may have stayed for their PhDs, but they were all intending to go home.
Sure.
But what happened in 1949 is that the U.S. government forbade them from going back because it was feared that they would go back and help the communists. And so they cut a deal with the Guangdong, which is the nationalists, to keep these scientists in the United States. So literally people were being taken off the boats in Hawaii. I mean, they were literally held here against their will. And so my father was one of the people who got stuck here. I mean, like I said, he had never intended to stay
here. His family was back in China.
Yeah. Everybody he knew, his whole family, everyone was in China. Why would you stay here? In any case, so the result was that, he was offered citizenship under a Refugee Act. And my father said, I am not a refugee. I'm a political prisoner.
He was a resistor.
So he refused citizenship with the result that, I was in third grade. My father still wasn't a citizen. Because his China had fallen. So he was not really a citizen of any country.
Was your mother a citizen?
My mother did become a citizen through the Catholic Church. My father refused. And so, I grew up in and by the time things finally straightened out and my father was a citizen and, they have this daughter who goes to an Ivy League school, the last thing in the world they want is to see her throw it all away.
And become a writer.
I mean, truly, and I understand that today. I mean, people ask me all the time, would you let your kids become a writer? And I said, well, of course, but I also say, but I would start saving now. I understand, what their concern was. But in any case, but it was not the path. And I had internalized that, so it's not like they even had to say to me, you can't become a writer. I mean, they did eventually say that. But I myself, I was pre-med, I was pre-law. I always say I became writer by process of elimination. Basically, I was in business school, when I finally realized, I just can't do this,
That is, it's so interesting because it is the story of so many immigrant kids who became writers.
Yeah.
We were discussing with Minjin Lee, and she went to law school, became a lawyer, and then gave that up to be able to write. And it, a lot of familial pressure to sort of do that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And I was just in Oakland where I was with two other people who were kind of my generation, had gone to these Ivy League schools, and it was a trifecta. One had dropped out of medical school, one had dropped out of law school, and I had dropped out of business school. Three of us,
Right, exactly.
I do think there's, and like I say, there's a reason for that kind of concern.
Was your father able to work as an engineer after when they kept him here?
Finally, yeah. But I will say that for many, many years, I mean, he was among the Chinese engineers. And they designed things like the Beltway in Washington. They never got any credit whatsoever. And, they would design things and then they would all be laid off. So none of them ever made it into management. And none of them were ever credited for their work. I mean, so, you know, and my father remembers very well the way, you know, they would sit on these wooden stools. You know, it was very uncomfortable. Mm. But meanwhile, yeah, they're basically just being used as slave labor. You know, they did all the work and
no way. Chinese spoken?
No way up.
Was, you know, Mandarin spoken in the house? Chinese spoken?
Shanghainese. You know. But actually my parents brought me and my siblings all up English speaking. I think that was a very progressive decision of the time, because that was their way of saying, you know what, we're not going back. So the families that were still teaching their kids Chinese, it was like, you know what, we're just sojourners. We're on our way. You know, this is going to end. We're all going back. And my parents were among the earliest to sort of say, you know what, it's over. We're not going to be able to go back. Mm-hmm. And the kids need to speak English. And of course, what they wanted more than anything was for us to speak without an accent, you know. But what was the result? You know, I have to say, when I was a freshman in college, and somebody once said, just close your eyes and listen to Gish speak. And what do you hear? And they all said, New York Jew. I don't think that was my parents' intended result, let us just say.
And Gish is not your given name either, right?
No.
That's a great story as well.
Yeah. So, you know, what happened is my given name is Lillian. Actually, of course, I also have a Chinese name, Bilian. And Lillian was actually very elegant because it's, you know, it both sounds like Bilian, Lillian, Bilian. Also, they both have the same root, which is the lily. You know, and that's a wonderful kind of Buddhist symbol. You know, you come out of the mud and you open up white and pure, right? And so, you know, that was actually, you know, like I said, that was a very nice choice on my mother's part. But I naturally always felt that Lillian was very nerdy, yeah. You know, and especially because I was so nerdy, you know, so I had the Coke bottle glasses, and, you know, so I always thought that was really very bookish, and I didn't like it. That said, I don't think I would have changed my name, but when I was in high school, I belonged to kind of an arty club, and we were starting to go into New York City. You know, we lived in the suburbs, right? We were starting to go in the city to watch cinema, right? And the head of the club gave us all nicknames. And so I had a friend whose last name was Houseman, so we called her A.E. And my name is Lillian, so he called me Gish. Of course, at the time, I did not even know who Lillian Gish was. I mean, of course, I certainly didn't know that she'd been in Birth of a Nation, or I would never. Right. Anyway, but so Gish, but it was a name that was really used by just really a small number of people under very limited circumstances, right? Until I went away to a National Science Foundation archaeological dig when I was a junior over the summer. And, you know, there I was away from home. It was a terrible storm, and so the electricity was out in the building. So we're sitting in a circle by candlelight, introducing ourselves, and they got to me, and with no premeditation, I said I was Gish Jen.
Oh, my.
And, of course, needless to say, Gish Jen, you know, Lillian Jen had been a nice Chinese girl. Gish Jen was something else altogether. All of a sudden, you know, I'm propping the door open at night, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, still, I have to say that, you know, when I first published my very first story, I published it under Lillian Jen, and everybody looked at me and they said, Lillian Jen did not write the story. Gish Jen wrote the story. And I realized that they were right. And so
I can think of you as nothing else but Gish Jen.
I know it's hard to, you
Lillian
know,
doesn't quite
Lillian Jen, you know, I, you know, it, you know,
beautiful, but you are Gish.
It's still my legal name. I should really just change it. But, you know, there's a different handwriting that even goes to Lillian Jen, you know, the Palmer method, you know, it's a very nice, much more legible handwriting, you know.
So who are some of the mentors that you had as a writer when you started writing?
You know, I've been very, very lucky, and I will say that, you know, I probably can't name them all, but I will say, first of all, that Jim McPherson at Iowa was incredibly influential. I got there his first year, and of course, you know, a friend of mine many years later gave me a present, and it was a poster, and across the bottom was American Vision. So I think, of course, I have written, you know, obsessively about America, and would I have done that? Were not for Jim, I don't know. Hmm. You know, I don't know. But certainly he encouraged that idea that you could write fiction that was concerned with nationhood and the American experiment. And also for from his point of view, you know, he never emphasized only craft. It was always vision, vision, vision. It was craft and vision, right? That was kind of unusual. Also, I will say that, you know, I'm fast forwarding, you know, a zillion years, but very, very lucky to have attracted the attention of both Cynthia Ozick and Grace Paley. Oh, you know, I mean, I can still remember the moment I was giving a reading in Harvard Square, and I look up and it's like, oh my God, it's Grace Paley in the audience. I was just like, oh my God. And I remember too, I had picked up a book. I knew she was interested in me because I had picked up a book of interviews with her that Mickey Perlman had done. You know, I was like, oh, look at this, an interview with Grace Paley, and I'm reading along. And she starts talking about me. I mean, you can imagine the moment. I was like, oh my God. And I also came to the attention, of Cynthia Ozick. And so I had the two of them, which is so interesting, you know, of course, OZPA.
Such different
two very different ideas about what the writer should be doing.
Right.
With one, as you know, I was, I forget what election it was. I was asked to be on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour to talk about, you know, what sorts of things we should be discussing during the election. I remember I said campaign finance reform. You know, Cynthia was really rather critical of me for that. And she sort of said, you know, you're being a citizen. You know, so her idea of the artist was really somebody who was quite, you know, apart from society. Of course, Grace was the opposite, you know. And of course, I think those of us, you know, I mean, I adored them both. There is a part of me that wonders if Grace had been involved in a few less protests, whether we might have a little more work from her. Right. You know, it's hard not to look at that trade-off and sort of say, well, you know, Grace, you know, did you really have to go to them all? You know, did you really have to get arrested, you know, all that time? Or because you, listen, you know,
well, where did
got a little more work done when you were in prison?
So what do you think about it now? I mean, what is the role of a writer now? You wrote this book, obviously, yeah. But in a very, very scary, dark time, what is the role of a writer now?
Well, yeah,
Is it more Grace or more Cynthia?
Interesting. I think I've come down right in between the two of them. Hmm. I think I've come down right down the middle. So that I do think that that, you know, like I don't think it's my job to be on the front lines. You know, I just don't think that that's my role. But I do think that fiction should be speaking to society. And I think that I think the novel's gone a little bit off the rails. I think thanks to the MFA programs, I do think that it's come to be that, I mean, I think it's important to record what it's like to be human and what consciousness is. You know, I think that's a great project. But I also think that fundamentally, I think the novel is about society. Do you know what I mean? And it is about the individual and society. It's not just about, you know what I mean? I have all these stirrings and, you know, I think the novel is fundamental. It's a low form. And I think that it is concerned, you know, it's not journalism either though. Okay. We need the cohesion. You know, there's a kind of special cohesion. There's a liftoff, you know, you need to feel that that it creates its own world that it, you know, so this is, you know, you don't want to write something which could be confused with a newspaper article. We definitely need, you know, and especially to feel like there's kind of some inner stitching, do you know what I mean? Some kind of invisible stitching that's there. And that's, you know, the voice, all kinds of things.
But I do miss.
I think we are rightly engaged with society.
No, and you know, you mentioned that Jim Lehrer asked you to come on and talk about what we should be talking about. I wish that there was more of that happening, where the writer was asked in terms of their views about the kinds of issues we should be approaching right now. I mean, a lot of writers have been doing that, and I think one of the things that, you know, I've mentioned it before, but as a bookseller, one of the biggest changes I've seen in the last 5-10 years is a diversity of voices that are being published. So in essence, people are commenting on, you know, what's going on in so many different ways, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, look, you know, every field is trying to diversify, right? And publishing, the results have been mixed. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, when it comes to writing, this is one of the most fluid areas of society. So it's much, much harder, you know, to diversify law schools, you know. It's really hard. So if you, you know, I just, you know, I'm a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Right. And if you look at kind of like, you know, they're always trying to diversify, you know, it's what is the most diverse group by far? The writers, mm-hmm. by far the writers. And so that's what, you know, so why, you ask, well, why should they come to us for commentary? It's because, you know, we are an arena where we have a lot more diversity, a lot better
what's happened is demographics.
It's not perfect.
Demographics are also changing to the point where, you know, you begin to see audiences develop because there are more voices out there as well.
Yes.
It's been really great. I mean, at a time when, you know, the body politic is moving against diversification.
Oh, God.
Diversity. I mean, you know, with migration and immigration, you know, I'm very nervous about that. I think there's a talk tonight about what the Trump administration hopes to do about coronavirus. Oh, and I know that there's going to be like, doors are going to start shutting in terms of allowing people to come into the country as an excuse, you know, in one way or another. So, you know, there's a lot of resisting that we need to do. And I'm really glad you wrote this book.
Well, thank you. You know, I think that, you know, of course, the vision is dark, but the hope is, you know, the hope is that people get to the end of my book and sort of think, oh, my God, it's so terrible. And.
Would you do us a favor and read a little bit of it?
Of course. But, you know, this comes at the part of the book where, you know, Gwen has developed her pitching to a point where she is on a team. They are about to play in the Olympics. I will say that at the time I made baseball an Olympic sport that, of course, is just artistic freedom. But
good fortune.
But the good fortune is that, that as you know, baseball is going to be an Olympic sport this summer. Anyway, and there, so she and her teammates are looking at the China-Russian team that they're getting ready to play, and because the China-Russian team has been genetically improved, they are all switch hitters. It's terrifying. Perhaps all this was fear, pure and simple, on the part of Gwen's teammates. But feeding their obsession, of course, was the sense that baseball was more than a sport, that it was a crown jewel. There were people who said it wasn't even invented in America. There were people who pointed out it was mentioned by Jane Austen long before it was ever mentioned here. But if baseball took on a hallowed meaning, it took on that meaning in our American dreams. For was this not the level playing field we envisioned, the field on which people could show what they were made of? And didn't we Americans believe above all that everyone should have a real chance at bat? Didn't we believe that with the good of the team at heart, something in us might just hit a ball off our shoe tops and send it sailing clear out of the park. If Gwen's teammates were playing China Russia for something, I thought, it was for this. For a chance to show, my mother would have said, that even if we all return to the dirt and the wind and the rain, like the plants and the animals, we had a bigness in us. Something beyond algorithms and beyond upgrades. Something we were proud to call human, or so it seemed to me.
Thank you, Gish Jen. The book is The Resistors. Gish, it's a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you so much, Mitch.